evening as our Shuso Jisei told us, this is the last full day of Dai Sesshin, of the great Sesshin of the year. And I think we've all settled into a very quiet space in our minds. Our Zazen, it teaches us when we come to Sesshin every year, we remember again how deep we can go in our Zazen. And while we may sit every morning for half an hour or an hour, you know, that's just a little taste of what we're able to get when we come to retreat. So we can be thankful that we all gave ourselves this time to do this work. And we can hear our hearts. We can hear what we most deeply care about when we sit for a long time. And we notice how we can make stories and ideas, and they just come up and we build these edifices of thought, and then, oh, that's not true at all. It's so delightful. It's one of the things I enjoy most. I feel fortunate to have listened to the talks that everyone has prepared and offered us their views on the Genjo Koan. They've just been wonderful. All of these different ways, you know, we're like these wise people touching different parts of the elephant and describing the elephant in all these different kinds of ways. I love Dogen's Genjo Koan. And my hope is that this year it will help us during these troubling times that we live in, that we can find some wisdom and some direction from the koan. We meet over and over again. Everyone talked about it in the talks, the kind of twin truths of form and emptiness that we live with, that we live in. Our ordinary lives with our ordinary issues, and our lives in interconnection with everything. Not just this moment either, but also everything that's ever been and that will be. It's vast. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh has a felicitous phrase that I'm very fond of. He calls it interbeing. I don't know. It's someone comes from another language and creates a word like that. It's just so perfect, the interbeing. You know, it's our scholars, you know, talk about emptiness. And you know, you just see in your car, it's going to go to empty. You have to get rid of that whole mindset before you can even appreciate the boundless nature of reality. But Thich Nhat Hanh, I love his interbeing throughout space and time, we could say. You know, and that's the truth that in our line, and in our Zen, Soto Zen line, we say that's what Shakyamuni saw when he looked up at the morning star on that fateful morning. He said, Keizan, our mother of Soto Zen, wrote that what Shakyamuni said was, "How marvelous. I, the great earth, and all sentient beings are simultaneously awakened." So beautiful, huh? Of course, this truth has been intuited by mystics in all traditions. I think of Zhuangzi, who I'm very fond of in China, but there's Rumi, there's St. John of the Cross. There's Hildegard of Bingen. She was a powerful mystic who saw that interrelationship. Teresa of Avila, another one who wrote of it. And then I think of all the unnamed women and men throughout history, you know, while they're washing clothes, changing diapers, chopping wood. And just in a moment, a flash of that interbeing. Like Ryo Sensei's example of the Pong family. He didn't mention the brother. No one ever talks about the brother. There's always one in the family. So, one of my favorite mystics of all time is Walt Whitman. So, one night on a beach, probably in Brooklyn, where he was living at the time, Whitman wrote about an experience he had sitting with the beach. And the poem is called On the Beach at Night Alone. On the beach at night alone, as the old mother sways her to and fro, singing her husky song, as I watch the bright stars shining, I think a thought of the cleft of the universe and of the future. A vast similitude interlocks all spheres, grown, ungrown, small, large, suns, moons, planets, all distances of place, however wide, all distances of time, all inanimate forms, all souls, all living bodies, though they be ever so different or in different worlds, all gaseous, watery, vegetable, mineral processes, the fishes, the brutes, all nations, colors, barbarisms, civilizations, languages, all identities that have existed or may exist on this globe or any globe, all lives and deaths, all of the past, present, future, this vast similitude spans them and always has spanned and shall forever span them and compactly hold and enclose them. What a magnificent vision. All, he repeats, deeply recognizing our simultaneous relationship with everything. You know, it's what we chant when we chant the Heart Sutra. And it's what Dogen evokes in this text. So you wonder, how did Whitman get up from the beach after that vision and walk back to his little room that he rented in Brooklyn? So like Shakyamuni and like Dogen, he didn't retreat from the realities of his ordinary life. He didn't retreat from his own body and that of those around him. You know, Shakyamuni, according to the stories that we have, at first was quite reluctant to offer the teaching. Nobody would get it. They wouldn't understand it. He just was going to stay with this mystic reality that he saw. But he was finally convinced by the people that met him originally to go ahead and teach, and spent the rest of his life wandering in poverty, teaching. And Dogen founded his retreat in Echizen province, opened it up to Buddhists from other traditions, set up a small retreat house while he was building Eheji, and another retreat house for women to stay in. Once when he was in that little hut before the temple was completed, he wrote this verse. Each moment, waking, sleeping, in my grass-thatched hut, I offer this prayer. Let us strive to save others before ourselves. This profoundly mystical man is concerned about, let us strive to save others before ourselves. Even in his reverie, in his little thatched hut, he saw the demand that he embody the teachings. And Whitman, not long after he wrote that poem, he began to tend the Civil War wounded, first in New York and then in Washington, D.C. He was a bodhisattva. Spent 3 years in military hospitals, nursing the soldiers who had horrendous injuries. There was no anesthesia, there was no, the amputation was the main thing that was going on in these. You know, if there was a wound, there was sepsis and there was no way to deal with it, just cut it off. He wasn't a nurse, he wasn't a doctor, and he wasn't a chaplain. He was himself. I read a recent study of his experience during the Civil War. It's called The Better Angel, Walt Whitman in the Civil War. I'm going to read you a little passage from it. Whitman entered the rank, fever-ridden hospitals in the nation's capital like a literal breath of fresh air, bringing with him a knapsack full of humble but much appreciated gifts, fruit, candy, clothing, tobacco, books, magazines, pencils, and paper. His long white beard and wine-colored suit, bulging bag of presents, gave him a decided resemblance to Santa Claus. And the wounded soldiers, many of them still in their teens, called after him plaintively at the end of each visit, "Walt, Walt, come again, Walt." He styled himself proudly on the front of his notebook, Walt Whitman, Soldier's Missionary. So he didn't stay on the beach, and he didn't stay in the study. He stepped out and served those who were needy at the time, after his insight. He was very poor, you know. He was a working class guy. He earned money while he was in Washington as a clerk. Sometimes he would do some teaching, and very much survived on occasional donations from other writers, because most of the other writers were landed gentry. Emerson and various people would send him little bits of money so that he could survive. For me, he's a bodhisattva of form. He may have been inspired by emptiness, but he's a bodhisattva of form, of actuality. Remember again the first four lines of the Genjo Koan. As all things are Buddha Dharma, there are delusion, realization, practice, birth and death, Buddhas and sentient beings. As myriad things are without an abiding self, there's no delusion, no realization, no Buddha, no sentient being, no birth and death. The Buddha way, in essence, is leaping clear of abundance and lack. Thus there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas. Yet in attachment blossoms fall, and in aversion weeds spread. I repeat it because I think it's so key to our ordinary lives now. Let me give you my pedestrian summary of Dogen's fine words. All things are Buddha Dharma. Each has a place, but nothing exists as a separate thing. And when we jump out of that idea and we face reality, we naturally become sad when we lose something that we love. And angry when something we hate spreads. It's natural. Did Whitman cry? Oops. When he got back to his room? I think so. Did he yearn for some able-bodied man to hold him? I think so. Did the stench in the hospital unnerve him? I think so. What is the energy and the power that derives from these mystical experiences, the realization of emptiness? What is it that helps us to grow many arms and hands to help those in need? Something when we get thrown into the house of the Buddha wakes us up in a profound and deep way. And suddenly, it's not just about my story. We chant about Avalokiteshvara in the Heart Sutra, how she saw the emptiness of all aspects of life. And then we say, and therefore the end of misfortune and pain. Really? I think most of us here over this past 10 days have had glimpses of emptiness, glimpses of our relationship with all things throughout space and time. And yet, we may pull back out of fear or distraction or our own confusion. Are we willing to realize that the wind of the Dharma is here, but it takes our own efforts to cause it to flow? Are we willing? To act as Shakyamuni acted, as Dogen acted, as Whitman acted. To make a difference in this vast interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, in this interconnected universe. To not just be a cell that doesn't act and react, but to be a part of it all. You have to be willing. The wind of the Dharma is here, but it's our own efforts that cause it to flow. Are you willing to pick up the phone and call your government representative? I'm always nagging. There's a Republican representative in Staten Island, and so every time there's a bill, I send a note to Kokyo and Myoko with his phone number. I nag them to death. But are you willing to do it? You know, what does it take? It doesn't take more than a minute or two. They just want to make a mark on a piece of paper. They don't really want to hear what you have to say. You could just recite a poem. I'm for it, I'm against it, and then four scores. or willing to visit a prisoner, escort an immigrant, make contact with people who have different views than we do. Boy, that's a big one. Can you be, trust yourself enough to be able to do that? To struggle with understanding and help someone else struggle with understanding? To stand up and actually say no to the changes that are going on in our government agencies nowadays? To the cabal of greed and hate that's surfacing? What does it take to spark us into action? What realization will make you actually make a difference? Today, I was contacted by some friends in other Buddhist centers. There's a sit-in at Trump Tower protesting issues around American health care. And I wonder, if you were in New York City, would you be down there? Would you go over there? You could stop at the Apple store after. Or would you be just too busy? Not all those errands to do. But if you go there, you know, maybe the most important thing about going there is meeting someone else who also went there for the first time and making connection and contact with others. It's so good for your heart. It's so good for that other person's heart. That is a joining. That is a recognition of the importance of speaking up for the way things are and the way things are becoming. There's so many vital issues now. Each one of you probably has one that's your special interest. Perfect for a bodhisattva activity. Shinryu spoke movingly of climate change and the wildfires in the West. We have to support the strategies that the EPA put in place before the change in administration, and also look carefully what the Interior Department is doing. The Justice Department is now beginning to unroll many of the diversity rulings, particularly those associated with gays and lesbians and trans people. So we can encourage the ACLU and the Southern Poverty Law Project and others like that to contest those actions that put immigrants and blacks and gays and other out-groups at risk, you know? You don't have to give money to every organization, but you can support them. When they have demonstrations, join in. Tell your friends about it. Talk about it. Because that's the fear that I have most of all, is the enormous rise in hate crimes this year. It's been amazing. And this creation of out-groups that's happening. Scapegoats. They function as triggers to incite emerging right-wing groups. You know, when Putin was struggling in Russia, he began a campaign that they hadn't had a campaign against gays before. And he began this huge campaign against gays and lesbians, creating an other that people could demonize and not pay attention to what he was doing. And now it's an enormously homophobic cult society in just 20 years. It's amazing. And I'm afraid this is happening here in this country. You know, I have a background in communications. It was kind of what I used to do. And I'm just really alarmed by the kind of stealth actions that are going on behind the scenes at the FCC. That's the Federal Communications Commission. We don't think about it very much. You know, it's a very boring agency. It regulates, what it does is prevent monopolies in communication. I'll just repeat that. Prevents monopolies in communications. So Ajit Pai, he's the new appointee as chairman of the FCC, is doing away with antitrust regulations and thus enabling an ultra-conservative broadcast group, the Sinclair, having nothing, no relationship to our Shinryu, broadcast grouping, is to buy the huge Tribune media company. This will mean that there's a single owner of TV stations in our country that reaches 72% of households, including most of the major markets. Now, this Sinclair group mandates that on their, right now on their stations that they run Trump strategist commentary 9 times each week. So this isn't just, you know, bad capitalist monopoly. This is something else. This is serious. This is where the hate crimes come from. This is inciting people, in groups and out groups. And as horrid as this is just the beginning of a giant consolidation of communications technologies. But then, maybe not. Maybe Dogen reminds us in his passage on the boat and the shore that everything is in the midst of change. When you ride in a boat and watch the shore, you might assume that the shore is moving. But when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you can see that the boat moves. Similarly, if you examine myriad things with a confused body and mind, you might suppose that your mind and essence are permanent. When you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self. So we too are changing. And my fears about broadcast media are probably, based on the past, on the 20th century, one-way media that we lived with in those days. But similar dangers are arising. The threat to net neutrality is very scary. What that essentially involves is if the people who are sending the data don't like the data, they can throttle it, slow it down so you won't pick it up, or they can stop it, divert it. So you trust your Wikipedia and you put something in, but you put in something that's hot, they don't want, it doesn't come through. Net neutrality is very scary, the loss of it. You know, so far, it's been treated as a common carrier like the telephone, and no one can do anything about it. But it's something to really pay attention to. As we in the media change, I wonder, how can we protect minorities from becoming out-groups? What can we do about this? Besides protesting what's happening at the FCC and talking about it and letting people know what's happening. But also I think we need to really support our local networks, like Fusho's local news analysis programming. You know, I'm a big devotee. I've learned so much about the Lower East Side and the politics in my little plot of that world. It may be by that the frightening pervasiveness of digital communications will dilute the power of those large media conglomerations that are taking over. What we need to do, I think, is to reach out to people who don't use the internet that much, that use it just for, you know, socializing and that kind of thing. We need to reach out and talk and help small groups to provide local perspectives. You know, the same thing I could be talking about rather than talking about television, too, say the same thing about newspapers. But what's happening is there is an increase, a beginning of local newspapers. The reason the Lowdown has been able to do so well is because they don't produce a lot of paper. It comes out, it's digital, so it doesn't cost as much. But it, if we can, whatever, wherever we live, if we can really encourage these small local news to come out, I think this make a huge difference in this, creating this otherism where people are, hate groups are forming around others. For every fake news, there is a verified one. If we realize that we're on the boat, along with everything else that's going on, then we can act. You know, as Allen Ginsberg famously said, that's one of my favorite quotes, put your queer shoulder to the wheel. You say, do it. Don't just watch it. Don't be a witness only. But be involved. We have to. After spending a week like we've just spent, really tasting deeply our relationship with everything, benefiting by our time and space, we have to turn around and act. And, you know, not a field hospital or a boardroom. But each one of us has a unique tool, you know, whether it's knowing how to compost. Could you cook a meal for the soup kitchen? Can you join a demonstration? It doesn't take much to join a demonstration. Just go. Visit a prison, talk to a cop about his job or her job, use your emails, connect with your friends, start a blog. You may discover that you're a fine writer, you just never tried it before. Communicate with your friends, your families. You know, if you're an artist, use that. Dogen reminds us that like the bird and the fish and the air and the water, when you find your place where you are, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. When you find your way at this moment, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. And that's all I'm asking. Will you show up? Will you push the air with your fan? As Dogen says, the nature of wind is permanent. Because of that, the wind of the Buddha's house brings forth the gold of the earth and ripens the cream of the long river. Now that last line has bothered me for many years. I was videotaping my Zumi Roshi giving teachings on this. And he said, "And are there any questions?" And I raised my hand and I said, "What's this about the gold of the river and the cream of the long river and the gold of the earth?" "That's enough, Inkyo." It was terrible. So I thought I'd just talk about it for just 1 minute. So the nature of wind is permanent. So he's affirming that wind, the Buddha Dharma, is here, right now. And realizing that when we offer our actions, we create the possibility of realizing great value. That would be the gold of the earth. We are creating this gold of the earth. And we turn the milky waters into priceless ghee that flows in the long river, which is probably the Yangtze that extends from Tibet, where it was believed that Buddhism came, all the way through China and empties into the South China Sea, which was where Dogen initially, when he visited China, came from the South China Sea. So we could further imagine that these milky waters with this precious ghee flows on into Japan, then to California, then here to the Grail. I hope I made it clearer for you. Let me offer a tanka to end this. Boundless space and time, right here we study the way. And roll up our sleeves. Let's sit a while, then get up. Much to do before the leaves turn gold.